Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And as we jump into the show, I will remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its 7 branches or go to mecu.com for more information. Anthony and I are joined.
No, I was thinking, Mark, before you introduce these wonderful guests you have for this half hour, I think that the bigger question in the last hour, we really have been talking about America's consumption of fossil fuels, how comfortable. It seems like some of our guests have said it truthfully, Mark. Everyone rails against America's addiction on fossil fuels. But what are Americans willing to do to kind of break through that? Are we waiting for the administration to tell us what to do? We talk about gas prices. We talk about wind and other solar and other options. But it seems like when the rubber hits the road, no pun intended, a lot of Americans are very comfortable with our consumption of fossil fuel. And I just wonder how far people are willing to go if we want to break our addiction on fossil fuel and all this oil consumption and other ways that we generate our sources of energy. But I don't hear Americans clamoring the way many activists are clamoring, and certainly even some of the Democrats and moderates in the Congress and the White House are saying. It'd be very interesting to get a call to hear from our callers about what they think. One of our callers went as far as saying we will never break our addiction to fossil fuel. We have to grow comfortable with the fact that we use them.
Are we willing to spend more on gas and oil? Are we willing to change the way we live? Are we willing to change, you know, we are 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's resources. Are we really willing to change that and change the way we live? We're also 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. That's something else to think about as well. But let's go to our guests here and have you join us here at 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts. We're joined by Jackie Savitz, who is Senior Campaign Director for the Pollution Campaigns at Oceana, the largest international organization focused solely on ocean conservation, and by our old friend Mike Tidwell, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, and author of The Ravaging Tide, Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and The Coming Death of America's Coastal Cities. And Jackie Savitz and Mike Tidwell, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
Great to be here, Mark.
So talk a bit about before you hit the phones here, what you see as a result of what just happened in the Gulf. I mean, the arguments are debating, is it 5,000 gallons a day? Is it 25,000 gallons a day? Is it going to hit the Gulf Stream and the loop and take it around? Nobody knows what's going to happen yet and how they're even going to cap this thing. But Mike Tidwell, tell me what you think we need to learn from this, then we'll turn to Jackie Savitz.
Well, I think the one part of this situation that most Americans don't understand is just the unbelievable scope and scale of offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Most people think, oh, there are a few dozen or a few hundred, maybe at the most, platforms out there and a few hundred brave American souls out there drilling. But it's 35,000 wells. There are 35,000 oil and gas wells in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Mississippi, Alabama, and Louisiana. There are about 4,000 drilling or production platforms that go with that. It's literally like a offshore colony. There are just literally, you go, I've been out there, I've covered this story, I've been out in the oil fields as a reporter, and you go out, for example, at night, and there's so many platforms around you that they're so lit up with their hazard lights and their welders and really bright, that at night they look like reflections of the stars above you. And they literally, these platforms in the Gulf, they're so numerous that they coincidentally form constellations on nautical charts. You look at charts of the Gulf of Mexico, and the boat captains have to know the platforms are there, and they literally, the thousands of platforms form coincidentally these constellations. Instead of a Big Dipper, you have these bunny ears. Instead of, you know, Orion's Belt, you have the barbecue pit. And the point is this, there are so many out there drilling for so much oil that sooner or later your human error is going to lead to this kind of massive oil spill. And if we don't like this oil spill that we're seeing and all the impacts it's having and is about to have on our economy, then we have to start transitioning off of oil, because there's no regulation that's going to get rid of all these mistakes and make human error go away. There, a person dies every 45 days in the Gulf of Mexico oil fields. There's at least one major fire explosion every week out there. And these are big risks that we're taking, and now we see this massive oil spill. So I think, you know, we do need to start thinking, is this really what we want in the future, or do we want to start transitioning to another kind of offshore energy, which is offshore wind? I think it's ironic that, you know, Barack Obama in early April announces he's going to extend, you know, open up new areas to offshore drilling, and then later that month, literally on Earth Day, the Deepwater Horizon BP platform collapses, triggering this oil spill. And then the very week after that, in late April, the federal government announced the approval of the very first offshore wind farm off the coast of Massachusetts. So coincidentally, you see the disaster of offshore oil and the promise of offshore wind. And I think I know what direction I want to go in on behalf of my 12-year-old kid, and we need to learn the right lessons from this oil spill.
Jackie, I want to just say very quickly, though, you said 35,000. You mean, what I read, there are 3,500 platforms with 35,000 workers.
No, there are about four. If you take drilling platforms plus production platforms, they look very similar out there. They're man-made giant, you know, structures. There are about 4,000 total. About 3,500 are producing oil. About 3,500 are producing oil. About 500 are drilling for oil. And then if you count the wells, because these platforms do what are called directional drilling. So each platform is actually tapping into several different wells. You have about 35,000 wells, literally punctures in the seafloor getting oil and gas. And it's just staggering how huge it is.
Jackie, I'm sorry to bring you into this conversation. I didn't mean to leave you out there like that.
No problem.
Give us your perspective as a campaign director for Oceana, for the pollution campaigns. What the Gulf has been saying to you?
Well, you know, Mark, there's been a renewed interest in offshore drilling. Let's be honest. You know, the whole drill baby drill during the election, as much as some of us weren't happy about it, that there was real sentiment there that was a smart thing to do. But I think people were being led by some myths that the oil industry was putting out there, and I see three main myths. One is that if we expanded drilling to places like the East Coast and the West Coast of Florida and the West Coast of the U.S., that it would lower our gas prices. The second myth was that it would make us energy independent, and the third myth was that it's a totally safe technology. The first two were well debunked by government studies. They show that even by 2030, when the wells are actually producing, because it takes about 20 years for them to get going, they will not lower the price at the pump by more than a few pennies. And we all know that prices at the pump change by a few pennies for many other reasons. And it will not make us more energy independent, government studies show. Myth number three was the only one, you know, still hanging on there. And I think we can all see now with our own eyes that it simply is not safe. We're having to stomach a lot of really imperfect solutions like dumping dispersants, which are toxic chemicals, into the oceans. It would probably be illegal to do it at any other time. All they're going to do is help take the oil down into the water so it doesn't wash up on the beach, but there's still a lot of marine life living in the water that will be affected by that, which we can talk about. So as long as we're in this impossible situation, really the only solution is to prevent it. And that's too late, so we want to try to prevent it from happening again. And that's why Oceana is calling for a ban on all new drilling, including exploration, in U.S. waters. And we know drilling in the Western Gulf is going to continue. People, you know, have jobs, and it's already happening. We know we can't stop that. But do we want to extend this this risk to all of our other coasts? And frankly, one of the next places in line is the coast of Virginia, which is, you know, very close to our beloved Chesapeake Bay. The other one that's a big concern is up in the Arctic. So we're calling for a ban, and we hope that public sentiment is starting to change, as it seems like it is, to help us make that a reality.
I want to take a call here, but I want to come right back to you, Jackie, and understand what's going on with oil spills and what's happening to our oceans and aquatic life and the dangers there that we don't think about or talk about very much. Let's go to the phones first at 410-319-8888, and then let's explore the reality of being able to move from fossil fuels to, let's say, wind, And many people would argue that it's not realistic, and I'm going to question our guest about that, and we'll talk about that as well as Anthony McCarthy sits with me here in the studios Mondays, and we're together, as always, 410-319-8888. Teresa, in Catonsville, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say that I understand that Jackie said it exactly correctly, and what you said is so absolutely correct. We only have a finite number of fish and ocean to deal with, and air and everything. When we continue to pollute with the oil, which is the lifeblood of Mother Earth, and we won't have anything left to deal with. We don't have a choice. It's just written on the wall. It's written in the water. It's written in the sky. We must take wind power. We must take solar power. It's like father son's up there crying because his children, us humans, are ripping the blood out of his wife, our Mother Earth, and desecrating the earth and making it impossible to even live. He's crying because we're killing ourselves, literally with bullets and doing that and killing ourselves in auto accidents and such. I gave up my car last March, and I'm really happy. I'm 69 years old. I walk. I'm healthy. I take the bus. I get where I need to go. If I really need a ride, there's always someone who'll give me a ride. But we can do better. We can go for wind and solar power and save the earth and ourselves.
That's awesome.
Teresa, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate you being part of the show. 410-319-8888. Your thoughts, please join us here about the future of our energy, given what's just happened in the Gulf. Where do we go as a nation? So, Jackie, talk a bit about, before we talk about the realities of wind and alternative energies, green energy, I want you to talk about the work you do and what is happening beneath our oceans that we don't know about.
Well, there's a lot of animals living in the oceans. When we look at what is likely at risk from this spill down in the Gulf of Mexico, we see four species of sea turtles that are all endangered and threatened. We're starting to see them, sadly, in some of the pictures that are coming through, washed up on beaches. It's coming up on nesting season for them. They nest on beaches. That can be obviously impeded by the oil. But also, just when they're in the water, they can come to the surface and be exposed to the oil when they have to breathe, and it can be bad for just about every organ system. And I think that's an important point, is that, you know, everybody's talking about, oh, no, what if it gets to the coast? And, of course, it will be devastating if it gets into the wetlands and the birds are exposed to it. But it's already devastating to many species that are living in the water, like many commercially important fish. The bluefin tuna, for example, Atlantic bluefin, very popular sushi fish, high-priced fish, already severely overfished, is spawning right now in the place where the spill occurred. Those larvae, they're very sensitive to the impacts of oil, and what that means is it could be a really bad year for the bluefin tuna populations. That could come back to haunt fishermen, not just in the Gulf, but all through the Atlantic. And then the other concern, of course, is marine mammals, which also have to surface to breathe. They've already spotted whales in the area, dolphins in the slick, dolphins following the work boats that are going out there to try to clean it up and following them into the spill area. And there's also things like snapper and grouper, which are also spawning, very important commercially. Oysters, they've already closed the oyster season down. What occurs to me is, I live on the Chesapeake Bay too, and I think about, what if it were us? What if we were the ones that were being told, oh, it's just about crab season, but don't be thinking you're going to eat any crabs out of the bay this year, or don't think you're going to get any oysters during oyster season. We're going to have to import from some whole other place. It's part of our fabric of our life in the Chesapeake, and the same is true down in the Gulf of Mexico. And I'm glad it's not happening here, but if they start drilling off the coast of Virginia, we could see a similar story.
I'm just curious, Jackie and Mike. This is Anthony McCarthy. When we hear people like our previous caller, and Jackie just really touched my emotional place in a very deep way with the way she explained what's happening in our oceans and what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. But I'm telling you, unless there's this disaster like we see taking place, and as Mark has said in the last hour and a half, we don't know. I mean, we know it's going to get worse. We just do not know how bad it's going to get. we don't hear this kind of passion, or at least we don't hear it on these airwaves, and we don't hear it from a lot of our listeners. Unless there's a disaster or a tragedy, it seems like people have resigned themselves that we are one of those nations that are just going to be a big oil energy consumption country. How can we change that debate? It seems even in Washington and in the White House, there's a certain amount of resignation that we're only going to go so far.
Well, you know, I think what occurs to me is, you know, big oil is trying to sell us on this. They're trying to tell us that we can't live without them. And the truth of the matter is we can live without them. And we have to start thinking for ourselves and not just swallowing every PR line that they give us. I mean, obviously, they're spending a lot of money to try to keep us thinking we're desperate for them. And the truth of the matter is, you know, when you look at a question like, should we expand drilling, and I know we're going to keep drilling, but should we expand drilling to places where we're not already doing it? Well, they say, oh, well, we need to. It's so necessary for our domestic fuel supply. Well, it's not going to provide fuel for about 20 years. In that same 20 years, if we took all the resources that were going to be spent on expanding drilling and invested them, time, energy, investments, manufacturing capabilities, ships that are needed for installation, invest that all in developing offshore wind, for example, we could develop enough offshore wind that would be more than what the energy is that we're going to get from the oil. They don't want us to believe that. They want to try to convince us that their product is better than the other product, which is not surprising. That's a business. But, you know, the Department of Energy says that we could be getting 20% of our electricity or more just from offshore wind. So if we start now to say, all right, we are going to transition, let's focus our energies, let's not expand drilling, that's going to compete with offshore wind, let's expand solar. By 20 years from now, we could be talking about a very different energy picture, and 40 years from now, we might even be talking about getting off of fossil fuels. And that's really what we need to do to solve climate change.
No, Mike Tidwell, let me ask before we run out of time. We're waiting for the former Governor Ehrlich to arrive to join us for the last half hour of the show. There's a lot of argument saying we cannot. The switch from fossil fuel to wind or anything else is, you know, this is not an overnight shift. We're not going to walk away from fossil fuels tomorrow morning. The shift's going to take 10, 20 years to make happen. Do you agree with that?
We've delayed way too long in acting on our overuse of fossil fuels. We've let the climate beast out of the bottle. I mean, you just had Bill McKibben on your show, Mark, a couple of weeks ago, the great author Bill McKibben. He's written a new book called Earth, but he spells it E-A-A-R-T-H. He says that we live on a different planet. We've had so much sea level rise, so much Arctic ice melt, so many more intense storms. I mean, those floods in Memphis just the last couple of days. I mean, every day somebody in America is getting whacked by extreme weather. So we've delayed too long, but the good news about America is when we act, when we finally decide we're going to do something on civil rights, when we finally decide we're going to fight fascism in Europe, we go explosively. We act quickly. And I think that when we finally decide we have to get off fossil fuels, and it's obviously not going to be one event, you know, the climate-enhanced hurricanes that we've seen the last few years, including Katrina, and now this oil spill, they're cumulative, and there's going to come a point, and this may be it by the time this oil spill is over, where the American people finally say, that's it, we're going to do it, we're going to put all our ingenuity, all our historic creativity, our willpower, our determination as a nation, and we're going to get off fossil fuels. And when we do that, I think you could see, you know, cutting our emissions, cutting our use of oil, coal, and natural gas in half in 10 years. No problem. I mean, Europeans use half the energy per capita as Americans today. The Japanese use half the amount per capita today. So clearly we can do a lot better, and we will. It's just we need to commit. We need to go. And to answer your observation, Anthony, I think Americans are talking about this. They may not be saying every day, I want to get off oil in the Gulf of Mexico, but there's so much discussion of how can we be greener? How can we do better? I mean, the Obama stimulus package had $80 billion in green dollars to help stimulate home weatherization, et cetera. So there's a lot going on. Unfortunately, it's been scattered. You know, it's out there generally, but it's not there specifically in the form of a carbon cap, which is what we need in terms of national law. But we're getting there.
We're getting there. But the question I asked both of you, and I think we only have a couple minutes left here, because we're still waiting for the governor, former governor, to call in. Is the reality of what we're, how long it's going to take to get there? I mean, I understand that most people in America would believe and love to get away from fossil fuels. Most people may not be willing to pay more at the pump if we start putting more money on carbon, so that we can do this, so we can switch. And it, people, many are argue that
you do it. You know, we've talked on your show, Mark, about a cap and dividend approach that Congressman Chris Van Hollen in the House of Maryland and Senators Maria Cantwell, Washington State, and Sue Collins of Maine have introduced bills that would put increase the cost of fossil fuel energy, so you would pay more at the pump, you would pay more for coal-fired electricity, but you'd also get a monthly rebate, a monthly dividend, and 70% of Americans would actually come out ahead or break even under this approach, and only those who use a lot of energy, who have the second homes and the third and fourth car, they would pay a little bit more in terms of net energy expenditure. So there is a way to do it. There is a way to cap carbon and to rebate most Americans so that they aren't hurt. Look, in Europe, they tax fossil fuels because they don't want people to use a lot because of their national security concerns, because of resource concerns, environmental concerns. Gasoline is expensive in Europe, so it's taxed to make it expensive. But higher education's free. Healthcare's free. They tax the things they don't want people to use, and they make free the things they want everyone to have. America needs to do that. We could do that by simply, Al Gore says, let's tax what we burn, not what we earn. So we could have a tax on fossil fuels. People will get more efficient, but companies would pay no payroll taxes. So if we just rearrange how we tax and apply fees, we could discourage the use of one resource and encourage different behavior.
So we can. I guess what I'm trying to get to, I'm not trying to say we shouldn't be doing this. But the issue is, Jackie Savitz, I mean, it's going to take. This is a very serious transition we're talking about. We're talking about moving battleship America around and battleship Earth, or ocean liner Earth around, to a different way of living.
Right.
In some ways, it's not being helped by the debate that most media in America are having.
Well, you know, and I think it's a significant transition because we have a significant problem. I don't have to tell you the impacts of climate change, but we're looking at things like, you know, changes in food availability, water availability, potentially famine, drought, even refugees from low-lying areas, potential national security risks. And the one I'm most concerned about in my job is the fact that our oceans are becoming more acidic, and that's going to mean the end of coral reefs. By the middle of the century, if we don't change the way we're going. And so, yeah, I think it is a serious change, but I think we as individuals, you know, because, yeah, people think about what they're paying at the pump and et cetera, and for electricity, we have to count on the government and companies to provide us with alternatives. You know, we could have had electric cars, you know, long ago, but we don't. But if they provided us with that option, that would help. There's a lot of provision that institutions can make to make it a little easier on individuals to make these changes. And, you know, I'm sensitive to not wanting to pay more for power, and Mike's right that there are ways to structure this so that we don't have to, but I can tell you one thing we're going to be paying more for, and that's shrimp, and we're probably going to be paying more for oysters. We don't really think about the costs of doing the oil business, but there are costs, and many times they're hidden from us. But at some point, they start to emerge, and we're really all paying for them.
I this has been great. It's always good to have you on the air, Mike Tugel. Great to meet you, Jackie Savitz, on the air. And I hope both of you will return. We're looking forward to continuing these discussions. They have to happen in greater depth and get our community riled up and concerned and thinking about where we go. And I do want to thank both of you for all the work that you do.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you. Thanks, Anthony.
Take care. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Jackie.
Thanks, Anthony.
Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
Jackie Savitz, Senior Campaign Director for the Pollution Campaigns at Oceana, the largest international organization focused solely on ocean conservation, and Mike Tidwell, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, author of Ravaging Tide, The Strange Weather, Future Katrinas, and The Coming Death of American Coastal Cities. We're waiting for the former Governor Robert Ehrlich. Anthony and I will be right back to launch this conversation. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And I'm here, of course, with
Anthony McCarthy. As we are every Monday, we spend our 2 hours together talking about the issues that are, well, we believe, are of interest to our listeners. We dare not be so presumptuous, I suppose, but very interesting. This whole race for governor, Mark, you and I talk about it a lot because it's a big deal for the people of Maryland right now. It's one of the biggest focal point for those people who are following politics. It's going to be very interesting, Mark, to see, given Scott Brown, given Governor McConnell in Virginia, given what's happening around the country, can Bob Ehrlich really mount a serious campaign in this blue state?
Well, why don't you ask the man himself?
Oh, good.
410-319-8888 is number here. We're joined by former Governor Robert Ehrlich, who, of course, is running to get that office back again. And, Bob, welcome. Good to have you with us.
How you doing, Mark? Good to talk to you.
Well, you know, Anthony's here. It's Monday. Anthony McCarthy and Mark Stein.
Hey, what's happening, guys?
Personal note from the missus to both of you. Hope you're doing well.
We really like her.
Back
at
her
as well.
I know you like her best. I know that. Both of you, I know that.
So, Governor, good to have you on. And good to have you on. I know you're in a full tilt run here.
We are, guys. But it's good to be on. Good to talk to both of you.
So let's just talk first about, in a very general sense, about why you're making this run. I mean, if did you see the Washington Post piece that, and I know that's your favorite newspaper, but did you see the Washington, I don't think you like either one of the newspapers, but if you looked at their recent piece, they compared the records of Governor Ehrlich versus Governor O'Malley, and, you know, you could look at voters not sure what to do and weighing those things, saying, I'm not sure, tell me the difference. Why is it that Governor Ehrlich is running to take O'Malley's seat? What's he going to do any different?
Well, I don't know what the Post did. I do read the Post, obviously.
I know, I'm just teasing you.
And I read the Post actually more than the Sun. but in any event, but the Sun's been very fair, I think, to me this election cycle. So that's neither here nor there. The truth of it is, both of you know, at this point in the campaign, you tend not to read papers much at all because you're running. Mark, the good thing is, you know, there's a lot of differences between us on philosophy, on positions, and from criminal justice to tort reform to the budget to spending to taxes. So, as I said last time, it's a pretty clear difference on philosophy and approach to the job. Dan Rodericks has written, as you know, on criminal justice. Maybe my position is counterintuitive. Maybe my position on the environment is counterintuitive for some as well. Your second question was what about, you know, why are you doing it? And the answer is, obviously, I think it's broken. I disagree with a lot of the policies that have been adopted down there in the last 4 years. We've doubled unemployment, and with the budget issue and the business environment, which is a big issue with Northrop Grumman's decision, and that's sort of the news lately. So particularly on fiscal matters, we have very clear differences. On some social issues, we have clear differences as well. So I do believe that the people will be given a pretty clear choice. I was very clear as well last time we lost, and people wanted Governor O'Malley's approach and his views and his values and all that. I do think there is somewhat of a different environment this time. We know there's a different environment. I just heard your Scott Brown stuff. It's less relevant in Maryland, but it's still there nevertheless. And although that wasn't a major factor in my decision, it certainly was an element in my decision.
Governor, I want to ask you about when you left office. There is a lot written about the fact that Governor O'Malley has had a very difficult run financially. And many of your supporters have written on my Facebook and on this show said, you know what, Governor Ehrlich left a serious surplus for the state of Maryland. But that's being disputed even by some people who sent
it. I don't know how you can dispute it. It's just the number. Now, I mean, it's indisputable. Now, and so, you know, what to do with it? You know, there's a lot of money left over. They spent it quickly. Now, why they spent it quickly is, I think, the real genesis of this. And they'll tell you, geez, the economy was tanking south. We had to spend the money quickly. And obviously, the facts are the facts. The $1.4 billion and the surplus and the multi-year surplus and all that. I mean, that's not disputable. The numbers are the numbers. That obviously leads to, however, the special session and a lot of the fiscal decisions that were made in the special session, which, quite frankly, will be a larger issue in this campaign. Because during the special session, we not only had the largest tax increase in Maryland history, we had a spending explosion, as you both know. So if you're calling a special session to fix a budget deficit, the last thing you want to do is spend more money, yet to get a very flawed slots compromise constitutional amendment done, they horse-traded down there, and they blessed about another $1 billion of new spending during the special session. So I think you're going to hear a lot of debate about motivation and philosophy, which I think is very appropriate, by the way. The debate about the actual numbers is kind of silly because the numbers are the numbers.
Well, let me ask a question about numbers. I mean, one of the things that people argue and that have been shown by numbers is that from 2003 to the end of your term, there was actually a 26% increase in the budgets in the state of Maryland, and that the surplus, in fact, was a surplus, but as your budget secretary said, it has to go in to fill the hole that they have in the next budget cycle. So, I mean, the numbers are numbers, but, and then, you know, so Martin Malik could argue, well, I've only raised the budget by less than 14% in my time in office.
The problem is we were spending state money. He's spending temporary federal money, which as you know, is drying up, Mark, at the end of the year. So that's a real budget hole we've created because we've inflated the baseline. But I think your greater point is, look, we spent within our means, and a lot of that spending was on mandated spending projects through the General Assembly, particularly Thornton. And, Mark, you know, we many times I was on your show, and the callers were calling, Ehrlich, Republicans don't like education and won't spend money on education, and poor kids and poor subdivisions deserve their constitutional rights. And I'd say, yeah, I agree, and we're actually following the funding mandate from Thornton. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say Ehrlich's a meanie and against education, and he was not spending enough. And then when we fund the mandate they pass, say, oh, Ehrlich spent too much, when most of that spending was on public education. And you guys both know it. And it's a mandate. It's such a large part of the budget these days. I'm not going to allow them to have it both ways, Mark.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy and I are here in the studio talking with Governor Robert Ehrlich, who's seeking to take back the State House. 410-319-8888, your questions for Governor Robert Ehrlich, and we'll take them in. And before I jump into it, Anthony, you have something you want to ask.
I do. I'm on Facebook right now. We let folks know that the governor was going to join us. Several questions online, Governor. Someone wants to know when you're going to become an official candidate, and that includes giving up your radio program, which they believe is a platform for you and your party, which is unfair to Governor O'Malley.
Well, I guess nobody claimed that was the case when Congressman Infume had his TV show for 9 years, and he kept doing his show, and when he became an official candidate, he filed, and then went off, and he came after the election. But it wasn't an issue in Maryland then, Anthony. Wasn't that funny how it wasn't an issue then, but it is now? The bottom line is you become a candidate under Maryland law when you file. And it was, in fact, the interesting story about this is that BAL, and we've reported this is not news, but BAL came to us and said, we'd like you to stay on until you become the official candidate, until you obviously have the filing deadline. Mm-hmm. And we said, we'll take a look at it. And we said, sure, we'll do that. I know Governor O'Malley has a regular show on TOP, and these things only become issues, it appears, when Republicans do them. I'm reminded of the fact that Governor Glendening and past Democratic governors did marketing ads, as you both recall, because part of being governor is you want people to come to your state, you want tourism dollars, you want people to spend money in your state. I become governor, I do the same ads, and suddenly it's, you know, everybody goes crazy. And so for the person, in answer to the question, enough of the double standard. We're not putting up with it. I'm going to be talking very frank about it. I haven't complained about, you know, Governor O'Malley, and he's the incumbent. Obviously, he uses state personnel to get to where he goes on political trips and all that, as I did. I'm not complaining about any of that stuff, but it has to be an even playing field. I'm not going to put up with the double standard.
You've accused Governor Martin O'Malley of kicking the ball down the road, kicking the can down the road.
Actually, that was the post in the Sun, Mark.
You didn't say that?
Yeah, I repeated their comments, yes.
Okay, but you agree that your position as Governor Martin O'Malley has kicked the can down the road?
Yeah, I think you've contributed to, and more, part of this is the fiscal realities of the political environment. I guess the national economic environment. But my point has been that certain macroeconomic decisions made in Annapolis have cost us real money. They've cost us job creation. They've cost us businesses, and they've contributed to the doubling of the unemployment rate, which obviously has increased the deficit. And let me give you guys an example. And we talk about the wealth tax and how popular it is, and how there's a lot of state legislatures turned to it a couple years ago, the so-called millionaire surcharge, which sounds good when you say it real fast. But the fact of it is, it discourages people of means from living in your state. It failed miserably in New York. It failed miserably in California. And now I have national news shows calling me and saying, would you please do an interview on this tax? Because we're studying Maryland as a case study in how you lose wealth from the sort of playing class warfare economic games. And again, Mark, I'll point out to you that when this bill was passed, the legislature, not the legislature, but fiscal services, the people who do this for a living, said this bill is going to make us, this tax is going to make us $106 million. In other words, we're going to net $106 million. Last time we checked, we were down $257 million. And so what frustrates me about the economic analysis and the debate sometimes is the tobacco tax being another example. We don't take the dynamic of human behavior into account. The sales tax. How many Maryland moms ran across state lines to buy back-to-school clothes for their kids this year?
Well, we don't know that. But
Mark, here's my point. We're always exactly that is my point. We're always surprised when the dollars come up less than they project. We're always surprised when the consumer, and particularly the sales tax, which is the most regressive tax aimed at the working poor, you can possibly pass. And we're always surprised that the numbers don't come in at projected levels. And when you throw in on top of this basic lesson in economics, a recession, nobody should be surprised these numbers haven't met their projections.
Well, the question, but then we get our listeners in here now at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Governor Robert Ehrlich in his bid to become governor once again in the state of Maryland. Anthony McCarthy and I are here on the show with him, 410-319-8888. Something keeps phone keeps ringing. It keeps going dead. Let's stay there. 410-319-8888, and we'll get you all on the air. But I mean, the issue is, I ask every politician. I ask them, no matter what party they're in, and I never get an adequate answer. Let me try it with you.
You've asked me some tough ones over the years.
I have done that. We've gone at it a bit, which is good, and you've never been shy about it.
I haven't. I tried not to be.
So the question is this, though. Every state in the union, except maybe North Dakota, are facing serious deficits in this country. And that the outlook is not bright for the coming years. And so we can beg and borrow and take from this fund and that fund.
Right.
Or we can, you talk about federal money. But the reality is, that something's got to give, or more money has to be made. More revenues have to come in, or you're going to have to cut education, you're going to have to cut public safety, you're going to have to stop protecting the environment as strongly as we are. So talk about what you think you're going to do to address that issue that we face.
Well, the reason politicians, first of all, are careful about the answer is that the pundits in the press and the opponents jump on whatever you say. And I'm sitting here in my study, about to go out in a few minutes, and I don't have any of the real numbers in front of me.
In general terms, in broad sense, what are you going to do?
In general terms, it's a three-part pie. It's spending scarce resources. It's not expanding Medicaid to an extent that you can't afford it. And Mark, we've had this discussion show many times. We've expanded Medicaid so much now, the eligibility requirements, that it's the prime driver of the state budget deficits you're talking about, even during good times. We saved a couple tens of millions of dollars during my administration on Medicaid by simply getting rid of the debt off the rolls. Nelson Sabatini, my health secretary, came back with that report to me. So the ability to pay for particularly state Medicaid is one of the prime drivers here. And, of course, it's what agencies can you consolidate? Now, I don't believe in furloughs, as you guys know. I didn't furlough the first time. I believe furloughs serve to discourage. But you can take particularly retirements and empty PIN numbers, we call them in Annapolis, and get to part of the answer, Mark, which is a consolidation of some agencies or reconsolidation of others. The second is the tools you have. You know, we left a long-term care waiver on the desk going out of office that would have saved the state either $25 or $50 million, real dollars I'm talking about. The federal government gives you tools as an administrator, particularly in health care, to achieve real savings. And you guys know how important waivers are to governors. They're big time because it saves you money and gets the federal government out of your hair if you can get them to approve the waiver. In other words, the federal government has a particular goal with on a particular population. You serve X amount of indigent people this way. But you can do it any way you want to if we agree with you, if we allow you to do it. These are serious savings, Mark, and it's part of the analysis. And then again, you guys, it's the simple job of, and I'm very careful with my word selection here,
yeah,
of job creation. Mm. Now, we get stimulus jobs, we get BRAC jobs, we get temporary
census jobs.
Census jobs. I'm not talking about those jobs. Now, to some extent in Maryland, the federal permanent jobs at Pax River and APG and NIH and Bethesda Naval and Fort Meade, they're part of the undergirding of our economy. You guys know as well as I do.
Mm-hmm.
But the private sector has to play a major part here. And I would argue to you that a lot of the economic policies adopted over the past 4 years have served to discourage small business people. And I'm going to make one further observation to you, which I'm really picking up on the campaign scene here, which is not as easily understandable by the average person, Mark, but it's part of the answer. You know, I talk to a lot of small business people, and you guys know the cliche, but it's the truth. Three-quarters of all new jobs are created by small business. So we can either get small businesses to grow and help the deficit or small businesses to leave Maryland, close up, and exacerbate the deficit. And taxes is clearly part of their environment and their number one issue, but 1A is my regulator. My person, Ehrlich, who when you were governor wanted to sort of be my partner in the sense that he wanted to guide me through the bureaucracy and help me grow and make money and expand my job base. Now that same regulator wants to be the sheriff and hit me, be punitive toward me. And, Mark, that is all about direction from the top. You know that as well as I do. I'm just pointing out to you that the third element here is this sort of nebulous phrase we use, business environment, but there are real repercussions within that element that cause job creation and job loss and more income or loss of income to state government.
Governor, let me open the phones here because people do want to join you. We only have like a little less than 10 minutes left here. 410-319-8888. Anthony MacArthur and I are talking with Governor Robert Ehrlich. Sharon Owings Mills, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Sharon. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Hi,
how are you?
Good.
I just have two questions. I'll try to be brief and then take my answer offline.
Okay.
First of all, when you were running last time, it was a different economy.
Yes.
Different, you know, different world entirely as far as money. So, in a sense, people can argue that it was easier for you.
And with
Governor O'Malley, it's quite different. It's quite different for everyone. I mean, you look at what's happened to California and things of that nature. So, I believe that taxes had to be raised, and we don't pay the highest amount of taxes in the United States of America. I mean, Pennsylvania has always paid much higher taxes than Maryland. But at the same time,
the
thing is that it's easy to say, oh, you know, your taxes are going to be raised. But we're in a situation where maybe that's not such a bad thing. Taxes have to be raised, and they have to be raised from everyone, not just as in the past where you give the tax breaks to the rich and you continue to tax the working class, the poor, and the middle class. Everybody needs to pay their part to get us as a nation out of this hole. And the one thing that the Republicans continue to tout is taxes, 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 but there's other things.
Well, let's let the governor respond to
it. We have a really good, honest, legitimate, serious American disagreement. And I just wish you could follow me around for a day. I just wish you could follow me around to the retail shops and the small business folks and see how particularly border Maryland is impacted by a penny increase, 20% increase in the sales tax, or the fact that now we're one of the higher corporate income tax states in the region. This stuff really counts, and I understand your point, and clearly the economy was better when I was governor. I'm not going to pretend it was the same. It'd be silly to, and I'm not going to pretend it was otherwise. But quite frankly, there's sort of two ways to look at this, and I have a very opposing view to yours. Yours is sort of, all right, let's hit everybody, and then we'll just get more money. But my point to you is we don't get more money. When President Kennedy cut marginal tax rates, when President Reagan cut marginal tax rates, when President Bush cut marginal tax rates, income revenue went up to the federal government, not down. Now, the spending increase, and that was both Republican and Democrat respective faults there. So I'm not going to disagree with you on that, but the fact of it is, particularly when you're in such a highly competitive environment and the Virginias are right next door, and there are 3,000 small businesses closed up in Maryland last year, and you have this sort of thing that sounds good, like you said, tax the rich, tax the rich. Who likes the rich? Well, when the rich move and we lose money as a result, we really have to think about, all right, no, everybody wants everybody to pay their fair share, but do we want this particular surcharge, which is going to result in less money coming to Annapolis, which in turn hurts the poor? So I just find it, you know, it depends on sort of what school of economics you belong to. I like the growth and opportunity school. That's what I've always subscribed to. It's a legitimate difference with Governor O'Malley. It's a legitimate difference that will play out in the course of the campaign, and I thank you for calling.
Sharon, in all due respect, let me just get another call in here, 410-319-8888, because they're calling in at the end when it gets people in for the governor. Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I did have two questions. I'm going to ask only one. I'll take the answer off.
Thank you.
Sir. I'm calling concerning if you have any relationship or any thought toward the Tea Party. Thank you.
Thank you.
Boy, that's a really good question and timely. I'm getting that more often. I don't know if anybody has any relationship to the Tea Party, which is what's interesting about it. I'm talking to two pretty smart guys here. I'm not going to tell everybody who's the smartest between Mark and Anthony, but we all have learned American history, and we all have learned about American populism, which was a 19th century agrarian sort of anti-wealth movement. Bust the trust, anti-Wall Street, anti-bank movement. And so I see this term misapplied to the Tea Party. This is anything but a populist movement. Now, I think the term people are looking for, and I would offer to both of you and your listeners, is organic, which goes, I think, to your question. There is no leader of this movement. I can describe it for you. I'm also just like you are. From what I see, and I've gone to two events, it's a lot of small business people. It's a pro-wealth movement, not an anti-wealth movement. There are as many Democrats, Independents as Republicans. And that, by the way, there are two warnings here for Republicans, which I'll add to my answer. So I think it's a lot of small business people who are fearful of increasing federal government intervention in their life and their economic lives. And they're fearful about their ability to stay in business, make a buck, and expand. My two warnings to the Republican Party are as follows. I made these warnings very publicly. One is, this is not 1994, and the Tea Party movement is not a Republican movement. If anything, these folks are as disaffected by the Republicans as they are by Democrats. These are people who got very upset with Republicans when they had control of Congress. They still haven't forgiven it. So anybody who thinks this is 1994, they're wrong. Believe me. The second point I'd like to make is this. It's not contrary to the first, but it's parenthetical to the first. Republicans will most likely gain seats nationally as a result of the Tea Party movement this cycle. There's no doubt in my mind, and probably in your mind as well, Republicans are going to pick up 20 to 30 to 35 seats in the House.
That's possible.
Whatever it is.
It's possible. We'll see in November.
Yeah, in November I'm talking about. And some seats in the United States Senate. The Tea Party movement and voters will be part of that. But what I keep telling Republicans, which you two will probably both agree with, is that the Tea Party folks are not aligned with any party, and they will hold the Republicans coming back into power to the same standards they've held the Democrats.
Well, you don't think most PMS Tea Party are not Republicans?
No, I know they're not. In fact,
you know they're not.
Are they right of center philosophically? Yes. But are they mostly economic conservatives? Yes. So, from what I've seen, the numbers, I see a lot of Democrats, a lot of independents, actually, to tell you the truth. There's just a lot of independents out there. But my point to you is this. Of course, Republicans are going to benefit from it. But since these are not really firm sort of party people, Republicans, if Republicans start overspending, overtaxing, scandals, whatever it is, just like they did before, they'll just as easily pay the price for it.
Governor, we're out of time. I hope you're going to come on with us again soon.
I always enjoy you guys. Love from Kendall, and I'll be happy to come on again real soon.
Let's do that for a longer time. Good. Take care.
Great.
Take care.
Thanks, Governor.
Governor Robert Arc has been our guest in this last half hour. We want to have him on more.
So many questions.
And questions I had about the rise under revenues under Reagan and Bush. But the reality was, what I was asking was that most of that money came from Social Security taxes, which were increased. Not from income taxes, but another day.
Another day.
Another day.
Great being with you, Mark.
Great. Always good to have you, Anthony McCarthy. Thank you so much. And thank you all for writing in and calling in. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Brian Boone, Richard Good, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, get new additional interviews, and find new stuff, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.